So we are at the stage of having roughly covered the kayagata sati, the kaya anupasana, the contemplation of the body on the base of the breath. Then we have covered the contemplation of the sensations. We have seen, sorry, I have to take this. We have seen that it is very advantageous to study different systems as far as knowledge is concerned, because they explain the same thing in a different way. This you will find also even in the Vinaya, the same rules explained in a different way completely. Also in the Shastras, in the explanation of the Sutras. So the Sutras more or less the same, but the explanation is very different. So this is what makes really Buddhism the science of wisdom. There should not be real dogma, and each aspect actually enriches the other aspects. And this is, in a way, this is most maybe prominent part of the Chinese Buddhism, which is syncretic from the very beginning. Especially, I myself, I am studying the works of Kumarajiva and trying to translate. He is the example of how to use the differentiating wisdom and the non-differentiating wisdom side by side. And use whatever one can use to deepen one's wisdom. In studying Buddhism is not studying a dogma, but it is studying actually wisdom, which should open our mind to the ability to see things in different ways, not just in one way. So we have seen this in example of the explanation of Vedana Anupasana, the same things explained in a different way, and the same also in Chitta Anupasana, the contemplation of the mind or meditation on the mind or mindfulness of the mind. They are exactly the same exercises as described in the Anapana Sati Sutta, but explained in a different way. And both ways are correct, both ways are applicable, and both ways make the picture more complete. Then we have explained, and it will come also very clearly from the text, the kaya anupasana, the vedana anupasana, and the citta anupasana, they combine shamatha and vipassana. You have combined the shamatha and vipassana, then according to the scriptures, according to this scripture also, then you study pure vipassana on the whole. The Dhamma Anupassana is explained as pure vipassana. Also in the Visuddhimagga, the same idea. So when you have the knowledge how to use both shamatha and vipassana to the best of your ability, then you practice pure vipassana in order to penetrate the whole of your experience. And how to practice this purely vipassana part, how to practice the Dhamma Anupassana, the observation of the best translation. This is the Dhamma here means actually mental phenomena which are useful to bring us to the liberation. When you study the Dhamma Anupassana, you will see that it talks actually all about the seeing the after having seen in shamatha the kaya, vedana and citta, using shamatha and applying it also together with vipassana, then having understood the whole, you then absorb the whole by vipassana. So that you can eliminate completely the latent tendency to the defilements. The latent tendency to the defilements can only be same principle in Northern Buddhism, in all Buddhism, can only be uprooted by wisdom. We have explained, as you read in the Visuddhimagga, the purification of the mind and meditation, no matter whether you study what Buddhism, the aim of Buddhism, and in my opinion, aim of all religion, which are true, is the purification of the mind. That is what is religion about. And in Buddhism, the purification of the mind happens in three stages. They eventually, as one progresses in meditation, they become of one taste, as Patisambhidha Magga explains, taste of liberation, taste of freedom. At first, you separate them to understand them as being one. So you have the practice of sila to remove the paryu, what is called paryusthana. That means those active defilements which lead to the misconduct by body and the speech. At the beginning we have taken the five silas. They are for this purpose. You don't kill, therefore you don't get angry. Killing actually means han. Actually, you don't actively resist. It does not need to be translated exactly as killing. Then you don't engage in illicit sex. All this is to reduce the active. We may have thoughts, but we will not do it because we are preventing by sila, by discipline, by control of the senses. We are preventing the thoughts to become the instrument of unwholesome actions by body and the speech. No, this is a beginning. Then we practice samadhi in order to shake off completely the defilements from the mind. It's called vikambana. And then when you have the experience of the pure mind and understand the advantages of the pure mind, how important the pure mind is that you get through vipassana, then you can uproot the defilements completely from the mind by wisdom. This is precisely also what you find in this text. There is a, maybe I should tell you some nice story. My teacher used to always, in Sri Lanka, not in Burma, he always liked this story of the naughty child. Hmm? explaining these three stages of the defilements. Hmm? So the mind, monkey mind, is like a naughty child. Hmm? The naughty child does not like to go to school, does not like to does not like discipline, but and he's very frustrated. So he takes a stick and goes to the forest. Hmm? Does not like to go to school. Because he is very frustrated, on the way he damages the branches, damages the spider web, damages, kills some whatever insects he finds on the way with his stick. And he comes to the middle of the forest where there is a meadow, and on this meadow you find ant hills. This, in Sri Lanka or in tropical countries, these big ant hills with the tunnels inside. Hmm? Have you? Maybe you have them in New Mexico also. Hmm? They are white ants which create very big structures like pyramids, hmm? Sometimes even as high as a man. Hmm? And there are tunnels inside. And who crawls inside? The cobra. Hmm? The cobra crawls inside into these tunnels and is sleeping inside. Hmm? Now the child comes with a stick and start poking and at these white ants and inside the anthill into these tunnels. So the cobra wakes up. Hmm? Then, if he continues poking, then the cobra comes out and bites him. He may die or he may experience terrible pain. Hmm? Similarly, this cobra symbolizes the defilements. Hmm? Now, if you don't discipline the mind, the defilements will, they will come out. Hmm? In non-disciplined mind, always the unwholesome thoughts will come out. Hmm? Then, that is like cobra waking up. Then, if you continue poking at it, it will come out and bite. Huh? These are the unwholesome actions, killing, stealing, illicit sexual, all these things, lying, and so on and so on. All these things, they are due to the following the unwholesome thoughts into action. Hmm? So, when one is in samadhi, this cobra is sleeping quietly inside and it does not wake up. Hmm? Because in samadhi you shake off the unwholesome. So it is sleeping inside. It is sleeping quietly inside, but it is still there. Hmm? So in order to reduce it out, you have to use wisdom, huh? How to bring it out of this these tunnels, this den, huh? And that can only wisdom do. Hmm? Only wisdom can have the way of inducing this cobra out of the den, and the anthill becomes empty. Hmm? This is vipassana. And we have a similar explanation here. So let us go into the meditation on the mind. Hmm? The text explains that the meditation on the mind, let me see where I have it. Actually, there is a little mistake in the text. Hmm? even if one does attain and is not, he has completed not attain. Can you see it, the text? Not attain is not there. He edited, but it should not be edited. It is a slight mistake, but it does not make sense. In Chinese, there is no such a thing. And there is absolutely no need to edit there. If one does attain the actual, that means the root, first, second, and third dhyana, one certainly attains also the adequate access means. The in a northern tradition it is called samantaka. Before you go into the jhana, you go into the by process of adopting to the jhana. The same principle you have in Theravada, but in a northern tradition it is explained as samantaka. That means the stage before the dhyana. And here what is meant here actually is access to first dhyana. It means is samantaka to the first dhyana. Actually, you can take it as upachara samadhi. But we will see in northern tradition they differentiate. They don't have only upachara samadhi. They have the stage of not yet arriving to the dhyana. And they have the stage also of samantaka. They are not the same. In Theravada tradition, you have four jhanas in the sutric tradition and the five jhanas in the Abhidharma tradition. You may have heard of it. So in Abhidharma tradition, you separate. Abhidharma explains everything in detail. You separate. First dhyana is without vitarka, but with vichara. The second dhyana is without vitarka and vichara. The third dhyana is then your second dhyana that you have in with piti, sukha, but with no vitarka and vichara. And so on, the rest is the same. So what Abhidharma in a Theravada tradition calls the first dhyana, the northern tradition calls approach to the dhyana. Not yet arriving, but approach to the dhyana. So you can separate them or you can make them as approach. Different explanation, all are no problem. They explain the same experience. So you get to the samantaka access. Means actually you get to, you can explain from Theravada point of view, upachara samadhi. Because only in upachara samadhi you can practice, change the object, see the impermanence. And because in the jhana, strictly speaking, you are stuck at the object. Your mind does not change the image. Some slight ideas or other feelings may occur slightly, but your mind is still remaining at the same image. But in upachara jhana, you need for shamatha, you need for vipassana, because you always changing the object. And in order to change the object, you need vitarka and vichara, both. So this is clearly what Theravada explains is you go to upachara samadhi and you study the mind. And this is very fascinating study. You will find it only in the Pahok tradition. You are making the memory from your memories, you produce the, because it is in your mind, you produce the mind with the grasping, you produce the mind without grasping. You produce in Theravada tradition 16 minds, here you produce 20 minds. I don't want to go into the details, otherwise we will never finish. You can see there are some slight differences and they explain the same thing but in a different way. What is not in Theravada is this evenly settled and unsettled. well cultivated and poorly cultivated, other things are the same. One knows it as it is, and one authentically experiences, he translates Patisamveda as authentically experiences. You can just say experiences, no need for authentic. Thus it is said, one experiences the mind and one inhales, one practicing, noting that one experiences the mind and the inhalation. So you experience the mind with the inhalation and exhalation, with all these different states of mind which you change according to your need to understand the conditioning. In the Abhidharma tradition, that is unique, you then study these mental factors which are the content of this mind, one by one. This is very unique. Only, as far as I know, only in the PAOK system you will have this kind of meditation. So you can actually experience each and every of these 20 minds with analyzing its structure of the mental factors. And in the Theravada tradition, this is very wonderful side of the Theravada tradition. In the Northern Abhidhamma, you have only the aspect of characteristic and the aspect of the function, or rasa. But in Theravada, you have to study the aspect of the characteristic, aspect of the function, which they call rasa, the taste of it. Taste of it means its function. Then the how it is manifested and what its primary cause. Pachupatthana and padatthana. So four aspects, not only two aspects. So you get a complete picture that each and every of these mental factors, they are actually dependent origination. They need a cause. They have a certain function, which they have a manifestation due to certain coincidences. And they have a certain function, taste, you experience it like this. And most important, they have this and that characteristic, like the characteristic of sensation is receiving the object as pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant nor unpleasant. No matter what object you receive, this characteristic will be always there. The object will change, but whenever there is sensation, it will have this said characteristic. Similarly, sanya, perception, the grasping or apprehending rather than grasping. Grasping is in Chinese, but it means apprehending. Apprehending the sign of the object. So, no matter what object is there, when you receive it in mind, you will apprehend the sign of that object. It will be the same. So, these, they are called also, among others, in the Northern tradition. We usually believe that in northern tradition they believe that southern tradition is the same, but it is not the same. It is a big mistake. In northern tradition, it is explained quite in a different way. In southern tradition, it is very clearly explained that all they are not svabhava, they are not self nature, but they are just a particular nature. And they are always in the process of the change. But the northern tradition tends to believe that they are there, exist in the three times. They have, so to say, similar, like in Samkhya, if you study Indian philosophy, they always there. in the three times. Only they are changing their manifestations on different explanations, but they are always the same in the three times. But in Theravada is clearly explained, they are not the self-existent entities, but they are products of the dependent origination. So, same emphasis, the dependent origination is emptiness. You will find in Visuddhimagga also. Yet, still, these characteristics, they have quasi always the same nature. The idea basically the same, but explanation is not different. In the northern tradition, especially the Sarvastivada, the Mahayana is kind of a critique of Sarvastivada. They have, so to say, own existence in three times, not in Theravada. Okay, this is not so important now. What is important is the next exercise is after observing the mind, pamodayam chittam. He gladdens the mind. He gladdens the mind by breathing in and breathing out. This is the second exercise. So here it is explained, when one gladdens the mind and breathes in, one practices noting that one gladdens the mind. And what is different? It breathes out when inhalation. Then, according to this, you gladden the mind, you lift the mind when it is sinking. When it is sinking, you lift the mind so that it does not continue sinking. And when the mind is excited or when it has kukucha, remorse or worry, so what do? You restrain the mind. Samadha hanchito. How do you restrain the mind? By concentration. Based on this principle, the five hindrances in the northern tradition, they are summarized as the process of sinking mind and the process of exciting mind. The sinking mind you have to lift, the excited mind you have to restrain. This is the principle. This is how they explain pamodayam chittam, gladdening the mind by breathing in and breathing out, and restraining or concentrating mind by breathing in and breathing out. Now, when you study the Visuddhimagga, the same exercise but a different explanation again. Very complementary. How you gladden the mind? You enter into the jhanas, the first dhyana, second dhyana, you gladden the mind. Then you enter to the higher and higher dhyanas and you restrain all these impurities which are called apalakshya. Purifying the jhana is purifying the eight apalakshyas, the eight disturbing factors in the dhyana. You purify them step by step. First, when you are in jhana, the most rough disturbing factor, apa means down, that which makes the quality of the dhyana inferior. The first, vitarka vichara, two. When you enter the second dhyana, you have removed this disturbing factor of vitarka vichara. Then, when you enter the second dhyana, you have removed vitarka vichara. In order to enter the first dhyana, you have to remove the five hindrances, right? Among the five hindrances, the most important is you remove the domanasya. Domanasya means anger. You cannot enter the jhana if you have anger. Then, when you are in a, when you want to go higher, you also have to remove the piti. The piti is what? Piti is the also kind of agitation. And piti is connected with a pleasant bodily sensation. Pleasant mental sensation. So you remove the pleasant mental sensation. Then when you go into the third dhyana, you remove the sukha. Sukha here, according to the Northern tradition, means the bodily sensation, but the bodily sensation here means the sensation of all the mental factors, because it penetrates the whole mental factors, so it penetrates also the whole body. So that bodily sensation actually means the subtle mental sensation, which penetrates the whole body. So this sukha here means the bodily sensation, but in jhana you don't have clear bodily sensation, but you have the pleasant sensation penetrating the whole body of the mental factors. It is penetrative completely. Why? Because the piti is kind of agitation and it disappears completely. So when you go into the fourth dhyana, then you remove all sensations. You have removed domanasya. When you enter the jhana, you have removed dukkha. When you enter the second dhyana, you have removed somanasa and sukha. When you have removed somanasa when you enter the third dhyana, and you have removed sukha when you enter the fourth dhyana. So no more opening for grabbing at the sensation, for holding the sensation, and due to that, the in-breath and out-breath also ceases. So you have eight apalakshas which are removed. So the jhana is purified. The vitarka vichara, the four kinds of sensations which mind can still grab, and in-breath and out-breath. So the mind remains in the state of perfect sankhara upekha, perfect balance, perfect equanimity. So this state of fourth dhyana is called the similar to nirvana, because there is no place in the fourth dhyana for grabbing at the sensation. This has disappeared in the previous dhyanas. Also the vitarka vichara has disappeared, and the in-breath and out-breath has disappeared. So no place for disturbance in the mind. So it is the ideal situation for vipassana. Why? The higher jhanas, arupa jhanas, they have deeper concentration, but there is no object to distinguish. But here you still have a rupa to distinguish, this mental image, and you have a perfect balance of the mind. So the Buddha dies in this condition. because it is the perfect connection of shamatha and vipassana. Wisdom, which still needs differentiation, and perfect balance of mind. No opening for holding to the sensations. This holding to the sensation is actually what makes the jhana impure. And in the fourth dhyana, this tendency to hold to the sensation has been removed. So, ideal balance of the mind. Now we come to the last exercise, which means liberating the mind. Now, it is clearly emphasized here, not so clear, but in Visuddhimagga, liberating the mind means liberating the mind. He translates as obscurations, but actually it means nivaranas. It is not liberating the mind becoming an arahat. It is a worldly liberation of the mind. So please don't mistaken it. It's obscurations is not a good translation here. In Chinese it clearly says nivaranas. So when one has fully devoted the mind to this practice, cultivated it and engaged in it repeatedly, as a result the five obstacles which we have explained, everybody knows, not the source of suffering. It does not make any sense. Because you come to vipassana, then pure vipassana, which removes the suffering. So here he made some mistake, maybe because the Tibetan translation is not so clear, but the Chinese translation is very, very clear. It is not the samyojanas, which bind us to the samsara, but it is a nivaranas, which bind us from subtle state of mind. When you meditate on the mind, you remain in this subtle state of mind. This subtle state of mind is the condition for practicing pure vipassana. And only by, in this text, only by the practice of pure vipassana, you can chase the cobra out of the anthill, and anthill becomes empty. So you are an arahat. So instead of obscuration, it is the avaranas, it is the nivaranas, the hindrances, usually translated. So now, when the mind is pure, no more hindrances in it, no more attraction, no more resistance, no more sloth and torpor, no more excitement and worry, no more doubt. Mind is very clear. Then one, by means of pure vipassana, one can uproot the defilements. But before that, of course, one has practiced shamatha and vipassana together on the previous three foundations of mindfulness. This is very important to understand. So it is not that one does not need the jhana. One actually needs jhana. But for understanding the whole and putting it together for Dhamma Anupassana, the abiding in the jhanas is not included. But for getting the clarity, it is included. And in order to practice vipassana continually, one needs to rest. And the resting, as explained in the commentaries to Visuddhimagga, resting in vipassana means staying in the jhana. Then you again and contemplate the arising and passing. Finally, when you get a deeper vipassana, you only see the passing, you don't see any more arising. And this is very painful process. For that you need to rest again. So it is described in the commentaries when you practice this pure vipassana, like a warrior on the city walls is defending the city. So he needs to rest. They always shooting at him. He's trying to push away those who want to, with ladders freer. In the old times, they try to climb the wall. So when he gets tired, then he rests in these ancient cities. You can see it even today. Sometimes in Prague also, you have this turrette, the small tower. These warriors, when they were defending the city, when they tired, they sleep in this turrette, they are protected, and the other bunch of warriors defend the city. So this is how it is explained. You practice shamatha when you want to rest, and again you continue in observing the cessation until you have gone through these three dhatus, which are explained here. Different explanation in Theravada. We will talk about it later, but let us analyze this first. So the process of becoming an arahat, you have to use the three dhatu, three elements. They are the prahana dhatu, which he translates here as, how he translates, let us read the text, then we will see. One must eliminate the remaining propensities. Propensities means anushaya, the latent tendencies to defilements. They are called anushayas. One must eliminate the remaining propensities of obstacles to the path of liberation from obscurities, obscurations. In order to do so, one accurately recognizes the impermanence of formations, and by realizing the past. It's all about formations. In Chinese texts, these three dhatus, the three elements, the prahana, viraga, and niroda, the abandoning, the detachment, and niroda, cessation. These three, they are actually uprooting the defilements. First, prahana, leaving, means leaving the defilements of the path of seeing. The satkaya ditti, the wrong view, and the attachment to the rituals. These three, they are uprooted. Here it is translated abandoning. Let us see how he translated. Then the next one is detachment. Detachment explains you go to the second fruit and the third fruit, and try for the fourth root. This is all detachment. Detachment from what? From some samskaras, from the formations. Here samyojanas, or the bondages, they are explained in the Chinese text at least as samskaras, formations, because they are formations, they form the mind. When these formations are uprooted, the mind is not anymore formed by them. Then one is free. So this is very significant. He has not, the Tibetan translation may be not so clear, but the Chinese translation is very clear. It describes the why dhatus, because it describes the formations. And in Buddhism, we use dhatu, we use element to emphasize the non-self nature. When you see dhatus, you don't see the self. When you see the self, you don't see the dhatus. So the dhatus have the meaning of absolute selflessness. This process of liberation is not based on the self, but is based on wisdom of understanding the samskaras. And when you cut the samskaras from uproot them, then this thought never does not arise anymore, because the thought is what abhisamskaroti, what fabricates the will formations in the mind. Very significant this. Thus it is said, when one observes impermanence and breathes in, one practices noting that one observes impermanence and inhalation. When one observes impermanence and breathes out, one practices noting that one observes impermanence and exhalation. This first exercise absolutely same. Anicca anupasi asasi samiti sikati. Anicca anupasi pasasi samiti sikati. I learn to observe impermanence by breathing in. I learn to observe impermanence by breathing out. Very simple. Here it is explained in a bit complicated way, not necessary. Thus, on the basis of the first, second, and third dhyana, and here adequate dhyana means actually this anagama I have explained. That means what is described in the Theravada Buddhism. Abhidharma is the first dhyana. Here is the adequate dhyana, one engages in shamatha. Now by observing impermanence, one engages in vipassana. Such a person's mind, being thoroughly cultivated in shamatha and vipassana, is liberated from the anushayas, from the latent tendencies to defilements in the mind. Now, what are these domains? Domains explain dhatu. He translates elements as domains. He's using, unfortunately, his own language, and it is confusing. If I did not have the translation, I would not, also not understand. So the domains mean simply dhatu, the elements. They are the domains of elimination. Elimination means of abandoning. Of detachment, that means viraga, and cessation, nirvana. Cessation is the same. Due to the elimination of obscurations here translate precisely samskaras. That's very, very confusing. By going through these three domains, through these three elements, he translates domains because it makes it more clear. Going through these three elements, you eliminate these samskaras, which are create the samyojanas which bind you to samsara, to the samsaric state. Is it clear? So by abandoning, he translates as elimination of the samskaras, of the will formations, to be overcome by the path of seeing, by the dasana maga, darshana marga. in terms of all formations, there is the domain of this abandoning. Due to the abandoning of the samskaras to be overcome by the path of meditation in terms of all mental formations, there is the domain of detachment. So by practicing the bhavana marga, by practicing the path of meditation, you detach from all formations that lead to the defilements. Then you attain the second fruit, and you attain the third fruit, and you are on the way of attaining the last fruit. The last fruit here is the what he calls the domain or element of Nirodha, of cessation, complete cessation. We will see this fits very well to the Theravada explanation. In Theravada explanation, you have the worldly cessation and you have the ultimate cessation. By practicing cessation, you eliminate the relative cessation to experience the ultimate cessation. This makes it more clear, I think. Focusing one's attention on the three domains or three elements. Here in Chinese is a little different, in peace and without any disturbance, upadrava. There is no freedom from illness, maybe in Tibetan, I don't know. One cultivates shamatha and vipassana. By devotion to such practice, by its cultivation and a repeated practice, the mind is liberated from the remaining obscuration to be overcome by the path of meditation. Thus it is said, when one observes elimination, detachment and cessation, the three dhatus, and breathes in, one practices noting the observation of cessation and inhalation. When one observes elimination, detachment and cessation and breathes out, one practices noting the observation of cessation and the exhalation. So one becomes arahat by these three stages. The path of seeing, by path of seeing he translates as eliminates, but in the text is abundance. He abandons the samskaras or the samyojanas, which holds you to the samsaric state, and then you can get detached. When you have abandoned these, the most important samskara to be abandoned is seeing the self in the five aggregates. When you have abandoned these, then you can detach from the remaining samskaras, remaining will formation, which holds you in the state of suffering. Is it clear? So, this samskara means abhisamskaroti. Abhisamskaroti means actually fabricating. That is why the idea in transcendental wisdom of the natural nirvana. We are, so to say, fabricating samskaras, so we are fabricating the state of the state which does not bring a complete satisfaction. We are fabricating that state. That's why observation, the obscuration, means samskaras. which prevent us, which we are abhisamskaroti, means which we are fabricating, and we accumulate this fabrication, therefore we have samyojana. Samyojana means we are bound. As Shariputra explained, the white ox is not the enemy of the black ox. White ox, the five inner spheres, black ox, five outer spheres. They are not enemies. They are not. They don't present bondage to each other. I is not bound by the color, but it is the bondage between them which makes them this yoke between them which makes them bound. The white ox is not the bondage to the black ox, but the bondage between them are this fabrication, these samyojanas which put them together and hold them together so that they cannot freely function. The eye can freely see the color, does not need to hold to the color. It holds to the color because of these fabrications. Very wonderful. Similarly with the ears, with the nose, with the tongue, with the body, and with the thinking. The mind can think without holding to the thoughts, but we are holding to the thoughts, therefore we are bound to the thoughts. We can smell without being bound by the smell or by the nose. It is the fabrication which binds them together, which make us suffer. So all the later systems of meditation, they are based on that. You contemplate the natural state when the two can communicate freely with each other. So the samskara has the meaning of samskara, putting forcefully together. They are not naturally put together, but they are put forcefully together. The eye is isolated, the color is isolated, but the bondage between them is the fabrication in our mind. So it gives a very deep meaning, but it is actually not from the translation. It's a bit confusing because it is very difficult to translate, I assure you. He is doing a very good job, but it is very, very difficult. Thus it is said, when one observes elimination, detachment and cessation, this three stages of getting rid of these will formations which hold the eye in bondage to the color, ear in bondage to the sounds, and the mind in bondage to the mental object. When one has shattered that, it happens in this process of elimination, here leaving, detachment, and finally cessation. When the cessation here means only final cessation, becoming an arahat. Thus, dispelling the mental afflictions to be eliminated on the path of seeing and of meditation, one becomes an arahat. That means one comes to ultimate cessation, whose defilements have been exhausted. He does not produce, he does not collect any samskaras anymore. By holding to the object, we are accumulating the samskaras. Now there is nothing further to do. Katam karaniyam. The arahat has done his job as far as the instead of aggregates of clinging, he has aggregates of liberation. So he does not hold to the six senses. So bye-bye samsara. We are holding to the six senses. So problems are coming. Coming, but also going. This is very important to see. One has completed the various aspects of the practice. Such a person is said to be thoroughly trained by way of 16 aspects. The 16 aspects make his mind completely pure. He has nothing more to do as far as the path of the disciples is concerned. But from the explanation in Theravada, they tend to believe that being a Buddha is also an arahat, it is the same arahat and Buddha, but in northern tradition they emphasize there is a big difference. The arahat has still the old habits which do not bind him to the object, but which make his behavior not pure. Like Gavampati, the great arahat Gavampati we have mentioned, he is always chewing. Why? He has been cow in many, many The Moggallana, when he hears music, he is dancing because he has been in heaven. And also his skin is black because he spent many lives in hell, you know. So these are the explanations. So if an individual who tends to rumination should we continue or we do in the evening, this last part, and then I will explain the difference with Theravada. It's very wonderful. You can combine very well. Rumination here means, I will explain so that you understand this end. This end is incomprehensible if one does not explain. This comes from the Shravaka Bhumi. Shravaka Bhumi explains the objects the Shravaka has to master in order to become an arahat. Now we have explained these four objects. He has to master the reflected image, which is non-differentiated, reflected image, which is differentiated. If he has not the realization, he has only these two images. Then if one is realized, then one has the yavat bhavikata, yatha bhavikata. One sees all his experience as non-self. How does one see all his experience as non-self? One sees yavat bhavikata, as far as one can go, is the five aggregates, the 12 ayatanas, the 18 dhatus, the dependent origination. In this world, one cannot go beyond that. That is yavat bhavikata, as far as one can go. And as far as one can go is also yatha bhavikata. Yatha bhavikata means emptiness, suchness. The earth, suchness of earth is hardness, but also suchness in relative sense and suchness in the highest sense. Everything is suchness. So he is... He gets by experiencing the object of liberation, he gets this understanding, which explains the state understand penetrating the non-self nature of experience. And when he has perfected this state, then karya nishpati, he has done what is to be done. No more bondage in this world. Now, in order to do that, he has to master 12 practices. It is not a dogma, just a guidance. 5 practices which purify the conduct. This passage is taken from that part. Purifying conduct practices. If one has bahu vitaka, same as visuddhimagga, if one has a lot of rumination, lot of useless thinking, one practices a meditation on the breath. If one has a lot of resistance in himself, one practices meditation on metta. If one has too many desires, one practices meditation on the asubha, on the non-beautiful object, because these desires arise from thinking about the beautiful objects, especially sensual enjoyments. Then, if one is deluded, one practices the dependent origination. In this tradition, because just images, dependent origination becomes also the object of shamatha and vipassana. You can take a dependent origination as shamatha object. You make an image in your mind, why not? And if you have pride, you think you are very smart, you have attained the jhanas, you are very intelligent, more intelligent than others, or you are specially gifted or whatever, then you practice meditation on the 6 dhatus, as explained in Majjhima Nikaya Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta, very wonderful sutta, one of the best. I always like to teach it. This Dhatu Vibhanga explains we are nothing but the 6 dhatus, the 6 elements, the 6, he translates, domains. The element of earth, water, fire, wind, space, and consciousness. What is there to be proud about? And you can also take these elements as object of shamatha and object of vipassana. Why not? You can make them mental images in the mind. Then you have so-called upaya kaushalyam alambana, that means they are also, you can use for shamatha and you can use for vipassana. That is a difference. And what are they? They are the skillful means to bring you to the deeper understanding of the selflessness. What are they? The 5 aggregates, the 12 elements, the 12 spheres of perception, inner and outer, the 18 elements, eye, color, and the visual consciousness. Dependent origination, again, it comes twice. But here, in the other, it is for purifying the conduct when you are too deluded. So you meditate on dependent origination. But here, it is in order to penetrate deeply into the state of non-self. And finally, what is possible and what is not possible. When you understand the dependent origination, you understand also what is possible and what is not possible. We always tend to do things because we don't understand dependent origination, we cannot know what action actually we can do and what action we cannot do. So we try to do the impossible, or we can do something but don't do it. So this is bhavya abhavya, meditation on what is possible and what is not possible. Like Buddha is scolding Shariputra, he teaches the how to go to heaven to a person who can understand the perfect liberation from samsara. So he scolds him. He does not see what is possible and what is not possible. And this is a perfect knowledge of the Buddha. In every situation he knows what is possible and what is not possible. So you have these 10 objects and they are practiced on the base of worldly purification based on the jhanas, or on the supermundane purification based on the contemplation of the Four Noble Truths. So you get altogether 16 objects which you should be familiar with if you want to become an arahat and do your job of purifying the mind and be free from all states of dissatisfaction with the world. Okay? And dissatisfaction with yourself. So we have crossed the time a little bit. In the evening we will then discuss the little rest that is there, and we will discuss a little bit, we don't have much time, how this Dhamma Anupassana is done in the Theravada tradition. How through contemplation of the mental objects you become an arahat, as explained in the Visuddhimagga. Okay? That much for now.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.